Accession number 30655, Mr. Clive Sutton, Reel 6. Now, so what happened? What was your reception like when you got there after this? Quite a journey, you know.
Yeah. When I got there, I went into the tent, and there was some military police and some Remi. At that time, the attachment was, I think there was about four of them, under a lance corporal. And we had a driver. And they said to me, "You're filthy," you know. I said, "Well, I've been travelling all day." They said, "What's your uniform?" So I said, "Well, it's all rolled up in there, you know, my spare uniform." They said, "You'll be on orders in the morning. You can't go on like that." And it was a funny tent. There's all mosquitoes all going around. So they all got into their equipment and got out their decent uniform that fitted me, and they set me up for next day. And there was a military policeman was going on, so we went on together on orders. You know what I mean by orders?
No, can you explain for them?
Well, if you go on orders, you go in this particular case, you go before the officer commanding, and he talks to you and welcomes you to the camp, if you like, and tells you what your duties and things like that, and probably assesses what you look like. And I hadn't seen this other chap, and I got a feeling he'd been in the camp a day or two. Anyway, we went in together, and these lads had given me, you know, their uniforms were absolutely spot on, really clean, starch, creases, the lot. And the layout of the camp in those days, we shared it with Canadians, and the officer, the commanding officer, was a Canadian, and he was a major. His number two was an English, and he was a captain. So the English captain did the discipline for the English, and the major was in charge of the camp, but in charge of the Canadians specifically. We also had later, we had Australians, and I think we even had a few New Zealanders. And I was actually complimented on my turnout, which was a real credit to the chaps in the tent, you know, because they'd put me wise to it and helped me out. And it was a really interesting place. I love Korea. And, I was about the only one who did, I think. But
what did you like about it?
Well, it was wild. The camp I was in was really good. Everybody, the MT officer was rubbish, but he was a young National Service military police, and he didn't really know a lot.
Hang on, you just...
Sorry. I've got to think about this, because it's more a feeling than anything. Right. Okay. Are we on? Oh, sorry. It's a wild country. There's lots to see. There's mountains and... The river, I mean, MGM is a very old river. It's got deep banks, and I've swum in there a few times, which is a bit silly, I found out afterwards. But people did. I mean, I wasn't the only one. It was like a beach there. We didn't have a lot of contact with the people, but with the ones we did, they were okay. You know.
So how did you fit in? What was your role as Remi with the Provo Company then? What were you there to do on attachment?
On attachment, they had a certain number of vehicles. They had, out in Korea, we had all the rubbish. All the old vehicles had been sent out there. And being a military police, they all had a lot of jeeps. I think at that time they had 40 jeeps, a 3-tonner and a 1.5-tonner Austin. And our job was to keep them running. Now, an attachment doesn't do big jobs. We get them running, and if they're too bad, we send them back to workshops. And if they're too bad, they send them back to base workshops. They call it BLR, and it's either backloaded or beyond local repair. And our job as mechanics was to inspect the vehicles every month, do any repairs that needed doing. And there was always a lot, because...
So how would you carry out an inspection?
Oh, we'd got a form 406.
What's that?
That was the name of the inspection form. you know, written on it, and it would be separated into engine, transmission, you know, wheels, tyres, you know, go all the way through. And so you'd go down and you know, go over the vehicle. And we had to do this every month, so that was a big job we had to do. If we come across, say, a universal joint that was worn or bad or the brakes were, you know, we'd take it straight out and do it. And we had a lot of responsibility, particularly later, because, I mean, we were all youngsters. We were all, you know, I think we were all pretty well, all national servicemen. I'd come through a course, but I'd never actually been in charge of vehicles. And after a while, they reduced the Commonwealth Division to a brigade. And they moved us to a different...
Hang on. That's later, remember? So.
Yeah. All right. And while we were there, we had an electrician, two mechanics, or it might have been three mechanics, and a driver. I think that was the MT. And we would do, I mean, in actual fact, we used to do bigger jobs than we were meant to. I mean, the jobs that needed to be doing on Jeeps, because it was so rough, the area. They used to, it'd be transmission, drive shafts, brakes, tyres. We didn't do the tyres. We didn't change tyres. The drivers did that. Hydraulics, brakes, steering, anything that we could get our hands on, we did. I mean, we changed the back axle on the three-ton Bedford, which we shouldn't have done, but we're having trouble. So we made arrangements to go up to a place where they were being backloaded, took and changed the back axle, which it's not a big job, but it was a big job that particular day because it was pouring with rain. And we were, you know, they gave us a tot of rum when we got back. I didn't bother because I didn't like rum, but because we'd worked out in the rain for hours on end, but it was exciting. We got driving. I mean, I could drive, but I didn't have a driving license. And we would take vehicles, and I mean, I've taken vehicles with three or four trailers on the back, you know, because the Jeep trailers, they connect on both ends, so you can go like a train. And so, you know, for a young lad, there was a lot to do. But we only worked in the mornings.
Now, tell me about your living conditions first.
Well, we were in a tent. We had floor. We were on our own. Well, there was a signals tent and a Remy tent. And
so how many of you in there, about?
Well, there was maybe three mechanics. Yes, three mechanics. An electrician, that's four. A Canadian mechanic, a driver, a military police driver, and that was it, I think. That
was so. Now, what was the tent like?
The tent was, do you know the Indian pattern, you know, where it's pretty kind of universal, it was in those days, where it's wooden posts and quite a big tent. We had wooden floors. And you can take the sides out of them. So if you're in place, when it gets really hot, you can take the sides down and it was get plenty of air. But where I was there I got there in August, and it was really hot. I mean, we had mosquito nets, which made it even hotter. You woke up in the morning twice as tired as when you went to bed. It really did. It was so... And there was mosquitoes by the, you know, thousands.
I'll come back to that. So that was the tent. Now, what about your food? Where did you get your food from? Was it American or was it British?
Canadian. Excellent. Oh, smashing. We had we used to go over the ridge into the other camp where the cookhouse was. And it was made on the side of a hill on several layers. And when I left, we still had meat rationing in England. You can't believe it, can you? 54, yeah. Because the war had been over so many years, and they'd call up, anyone want another more chicken? Another steak? Anybody? And the Canadian cooks, the British cooks as well, but they were the ones. They had a real pride in their job. They were regulars, and the food was superb. Really was good. And
so what was your daily routine like? You said you didn't work. How would your day start?
Well, we'd get up really early. And I can't remember what time, but very early, and it was cool then. And we'd go over to the other side with the military police for gymnastics or, you know, exercises or runs and things like that. And so we'd go for a run for half an hour or whatever, come back to camp, because you had to wear decent clothes, go and have breakfast. And then we'd work till lunch, you know, pair of shorts mainly, you know, and boots. And about, I think it was 1 o'clock, we were finished, right? But the equipment we had, I mean, it's the British government, the British Army, they just don't care. I mean, we were a Remy unit and we had the most rubbish tools you could believe. Nobody kind of looked after us in any way. It didn't matter because we were okay. But, you know, there was nobody to come round and say, hey, how's the conditions, lads, you know, or anything like that. We had no cover to work under, which was, you know, out there when I got there was okay. But the Remy in that respect, the officers, there was no officers there, just the military police one. But this was, I found most places was pretty poor. And, you know, the kind of, everything came from the middle ranks, non-commissioned officers. They're the ones who ran it, really. They're the ones who had the brains. And
how did you get on with the NCOs?
Well, when I was there, we only had a Lance Corporal. I mean, apart from the senior ranks of the military police, which, you know, affected us, because we had to wear their uniform, because the military police there had what is a modern uniform. It came out, I think, first there.
NCOs?
The NCOs were fine. The regimental sergeant major, well, that's a company, he's a regimental sergeant major in the military police. His name was Saxby, and he was a tyrant. But he was all right. He, you know, I mean, he wouldn't let anything go, but, you know, he wasn't unfair or, you know, he just had to be up to the mark, and he was okay.
What about the others?
He was the only one who really, you know, all the others were corporals, you see. Corporals.
Were you still a Lance Corporal? Or
no,
I was just acting, wasn't it?
No, I was now a craftsman. Where I'd been a private, I was now a craftsman. Because I passed my test, obviously, and I was VM1. That's right, VM1. And rank more or less didn't exist for us, you know. Except that there was a Lance Corporal in charge. He was National Service, excellent, knew his stuff. And his name was Coker, and he was only a little chap, but he was really good. And he was just one of us, but only he was in charge. You know, I mean, we did, you know, I mean, we would defer to him because, you know, he was the best of us.
And how did you get on with the other lads, the other craftsmen, privates, you know, the rest of them?
Oh, smashing, no problem, you know. It was just a good atmosphere. The Canadian craftsman, mechanic, I think he was a full corporal, Ed Tarvis, his name was, and he was just like out of a film, you know, one of these kind of hillbilly types. But he was the only one who did all their vehicles, but their vehicles were the new Jeeps, and they were spot on. They were lovely vehicles, and quite easy to maintain as well.
Now, tell me about this Provo uniform you had to wear there. How was it different?
Well, we had to wear a cravat. This is silly, I know, but they used to wear a cravat, a red cravat, and when they went out and when they're on duty, basically was if it could, it was very dusty there. If they were doing point duty, they would put it over their mouth, but it was actually part of the uniform, which we had to have. So they presented us with one, plus a lighter, of the first Provo Company lighter, and I lost mine, and I wish I still had it. And that was, you know, the first when we were the first interview, and what was I going to say? We used the corporal's mess, you know, because they were all corporals, so we used the same mess, and we had to pay our dues just the same. And we used to have a film every evening, and a different film every evening, because there's nowhere to go. And it was just...
How were the films shown? Can you tell us about that?
They had a... there was one chap in charge of the projector, and he had a really good projector. And I don't know what the arrangement was, but they would collect a film, a different film every day. And every evening we'd go down and get a beer and sit and watch a film. Everybody in the camp went. I'm just trying to think of what we had to do. I'll tell you something about our duties in a moment, because that was quite scary in a way. Can I go on to that? We had to do a duty fitter every 4 days. So our job was to start the generators, put them out, and we had a superb generator. It was an American one. It was lent to us by the Canadians, and it was under a kind of generator cover, open at the sides, and it was. Funny enough, the self-starter didn't work, but you just had one turn on it and it started, and all the controls at the back were superb, and it was a lovely machine. And so every 4 days you used to have to go and keep it fueled up, put fuel in, start it up at lighting up time, wait until a certain time, go back and switch it off, a couple of flashes to let them know, give them 5 minutes, and then switch it off. But then, for some reason, the Canadians came and took it away. And I don't think we had any warning. We didn't have any lights for, I think, for a day. Right.
So you're talking about, is that all we had to do as duty fitter? That sounds like just switching a generator on.
No, we had to be available to go out to bring in any vehicles that were got trouble, or even go out and fix them. Which, strange enough, I can't remember doing it. It didn't happen very often.
So what was it? You said it was quite exciting and scary being duty fitter.
Well, when they took this generator away, and I've told people, and they don't believe me, and I can hardly believe it myself now. But for some, somehow they got another rough old generator. You know, it wasn't like this one. And it didn't have a fuel tank. And I think we must have done it, you know, the people who are mechanics. And they cut a petrol drum, 50-gallon petrol drum, that way, which is from end to end. So it was like a big open dish. And we used to fill it with petrol with just a feed pipe down to the carburetor with a little valve, a little tap on the inside, and started up and it would go. But halfway through, but this is the point, the manifold used to get red hot. And the petrol was undercover with an open top. It had to be undercover, so it was close to the generator. So you'd got a red hot manifold, an open of maybe 30 gallons of fuel, and you had to put your hand along in between, switch it off, wait for it to cool a bit, top it up in the evening, start it up, and then at the last thing at night, go along, put your hand in between the two and switch it off. How nobody was killed, I don't know, because they would not have stood a chance. Anyway, after a while, they reduced the Commonwealth Division to a brigade.
And what did that mean for you?
Well, it meant more responsibility for me, because all the other Remy lads were demobbed. Were posted. I think they went home. The unit was reduced, and I think instead of we having 40 Jeeps, we had 25. Still had the three-tonners. But... And then they sent in another mechanic, And it was just he and I, and he didn't know anything, and I was only just a little bit ahead of him. And but you know, more or less recognised that I was the senior of the two, although he was a regular. And now we were in charge of 25 vehicles, just us. And I'll tell you one anecdote, if you like. We had this big, I don't know how big the scheme was, but we were involved in it. And the military police have to do specific things, you know.
Is it training exercise?
Probably, yeah. And so I was talking it over with this other lad. His name was Saxby as well, funny enough. And I said, you know, I said, these vehicles are not going to start in the morning because they were terrible, you know, because the batteries were old. And anyway, so we got up about 3-4 in the morning. We went out into the vehicle park, and we fueled them all up, made sure they'd got enough fuel, started what we could, towed the rest, and when they had their briefing, all their vehicles were lined up in a line for them. And nobody had told us to do this. You know, we'd just done it off. And they had their briefing, and they came out like a fighter pilots, you know, all jumped into their thing, vroom, and off they went. And only one didn't start. And he said, I did it on purpose, but I didn't. And, but, you know, nobody said, well done. No, you know, I suppose they thought somebody had told us to do it, but we hadn't. We'd done it off our own bat, you know. By then we'd moved to what they call, it was main div headquarters. We'd gone.
Where was that near?
That was near Castle Hill and Gloucester Valley. You've are familiar with those.
So was it, which was it nearest? Was it on the hill or in the valley?
In the valley. Yeah, we could walk to the hill though. And
what was the name of the valley again? Sorry, I've,
Gloucester Valley.
Gloucester Valley.
And it's very much like Cheddar Gorge, only much wilder. It's lovely through there. And but on the way, before we moved, I had to. I had two little things happen to me. I had to go backwards and forwards, taking things by jeep. We had our own jeep, incidentally, which was rather nice. And anyway, I had to take the jeep to main div to the new camp. And the quartermaster said to me, asked me if I'd take a keg of rum for him, you know, the China. And I, you know, I mean, I did, of course. And I wrapped it in a Canadian guy's sleeping bag. And I, when I got there, I think I must have been driving a bit fast. 25 mile an hour maximum on the roads. But anyway, when we got there, I'd knocked the head off this this rum. And they thought, first of all, that I'd done it and drunk it. But, you know, they could tell I'd been drinking it because I had no smell of breath or rum or anything. But it all got into this chap's sleeping bag. And who I didn't, it was an older man because they were regulars, the Canadians. And I said to him afterwards, I said, I'm sorry about your sleeping bag. And he said, oh, it's all right. He said, I've never had such a good night's sleep before. And another time I was taking two trailers, and I turned one of them over. I don't know how I did it. And the second one turned over, or one of them, I can't remember which. And I was in no man's land now, you know. I was in what we call rock territory. That's the Republic of Korea, and they would steal anything, you know, the army. So anyway, I was trying. I could not turn this one back. So I'm stuck in the middle of nowhere, and an English lorry came along with all guys in it, and they jumped out and they turned it over for me. And the sergeant said to me, "Now keep your speed down."
What did you think of the jeep? Tell me a bit about the jeep.
The jeep was a smashing vehicle. It really was.
What was so good about it? Because a lot of people say that
it was light. If the engine had been a bit better, it'd have been fantastic. But a side valve engine, It was quite good, and you could take them anywhere. And in Korea, we were quite a little way short of the demilitarized zone, DMZ. And there was different lines. There was the Kansas line and others. And we had a bug out kit. We had to, because the Chinese were really quite close. They were only just about 3 or 4 or 5 miles away.
Explain what a bug out kit is for them.
And we just had to have kind of personal things, our own things there, so that we could just pick it up and go. And if the Chinese came through the DMZ, we had an aircraft, Osters, going up and down, you know, looking into Chinese positions, North Korean positions, to see if anything was moving. And if they came, they'd just a signal come bug out, pick up their stuff, get a vehicle, and go up to the first line, which they tell me was we had to hold the line for 2 hours, and then we were expendable. And then there's another line behind, apparently, and they would hold it for longer. That was, you know, that was what they were, the first lines of defence. So we were quite close to the action, really, which didn't happen. But the Osters used to go up along and back all the time. Anyway.
Now, so anything happened, any of the stories, to, you know, during this period when you're at Gloucester Valley Camp, we'll call it?
Yeah, well, when we had this scheme, my job was to go through Gloucester Valley to a camp on the other side and stay there all day for any vehicles, and they would know I was there and they could bring them in or I'd go out to them. And during the day, there was a village in between the two, and an American truck knocked a little girl down and killed her. And they left a body in the middle of the road. We knew that. Like, we knew we had to go back that way. So we were people coming and say, "Oh, the body's still there." But that was because the military police had to, you know, do all their accident checks and things. But then the Koreans wouldn't take it, because they reckoned it'd be photographed and all the rest of it, and it was contaminated, you know, these white people think, and they wouldn't take the body back. So anyway, so I'm waiting there, waiting for the scheme at the end of the day to go home, to go back. And in the middle of the day, a captain who'd come from Japan, I don't know what, he wasn't one of ours, he was being driven in to go to speak to someone covering the exercise, I should imagine. Anyway, so when he went out, he said to his driver, "I'm just going to use the jeep, I'm going down the road." So what the driver didn't know is that some of his pals there had altered his plug leads around. So when he went out, it was misfiring all over the place. So he kind of went past us, stopped and came back, and they sent me over to him, and I knew exactly what had happened. You know, not anybody had told me, I just knew what it was. So I said, "Oh," I said, this vehicle's in, you know, in real trouble." So I said, "Well, look, you know, leave it to me, I'll have a look at it. Come back in about, go and have a cup of tea." I said, "No, I'll either come over or come back and I'll fix it." So I just put the leads on the correct ones and left it for a little while. And he said, when he came back, of course, he was running really sweetly. And he's saying, you're really first-class mechanic. I'm so admiring." I've done nothing. Yeah, it wasn't the only time that something like that happened. But and when I went back in the evening, the body wasn't there. So I was... Another time, when I was first there, I used to go out with the post corporal sometimes. And he was in charge of the post in the camp, and every afternoon he'd go out and to the post, you know, place. I'm not sure where it was, or whether it was Imjin or something as far as that. I'm not quite sure, because that was the railhead. Anyway, so I used to go out with him sometimes, just be on patrol kind of thing, you know, not on patrol, just to, you know, to get out the place. And